Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
Hey, I'm Christian Sager.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And we're all three gathering for this one once more because the summer reading episode is kind of a tradition with the Stuff to Blow Your Mind, where we highlight some interesting books that we've read, are reading, that we're looking to read, stuff that may or may not appeal to Stuff to Blow Your Mind listeners, might make for some good beach reading, some intelligent beach reading, if that's your thing. So, yeah.
I think it's also probably a good opportunity for the audience to get to know Joe and I a little bit better, too, kind of what our interests are and perhaps some parts of our personalities that maybe haven't come through yet in episodes about things like stigmata and glass mind conditions.
Like you don't already know what kind of a creep I am.
I do, but the audience doesn't.
Yeah, that's what this is about, exposing our inner secrets and creepiness to the listeners. And it tends to result in a lot of cool conversations with listeners because either they've read the books that we're talking about and have some feedback, or they have some recommendations based on some of what we're chatting about. So I look forward to all that interaction.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was hoping for out of this, was that we'd get some nice engagement and conversations going with the listeners, and that they could possibly recommend some stuff back to us as well. You can contact us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, where we are Blow the Mind, or you can write us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you thought about, you know, the recommendations we're about to give here, and let us know what your recommendations are based on what we tell you. Maybe you've got something that you can tell us about that one of the three of us or all three of us will want to dive into.
Yeah, and inevitably there are going to be questions about the titles. You know, what was that book you mentioned? How do you spell the last name of that author? We're going to make sure that on the landing page for this episode we'll have all the books that we specifically call out here, as well as links to where you can obtain them.
So, you know, getting into choosing books for this episode, one of the things I noticed was how little I've been reading the ideal kind of book to talk about on Stuff to Blow Your Mind in the past couple of years.
What do you mean?
I don't know. I feel like, you know, what do I want to give this audience? I want to give them something very, like, strange science fiction or something like that, and I haven't been getting into that much lately. I mean, I still love it, but
yeah,
just haven't been reading it.
Yeah. I could see that, but I go through phases with content like that, I think. I mean, you're going to find out today that I'm obviously in a big horror phase, which is probably no surprise to anyone who's familiar with the stuff that I do outside of How Stuff Works. But yeah, I think that that stuff ebbs and flows.
Mm-hmm.
For my own part, we moved offices here at How Stuff Works. We used to be located up in Buckhead, and now we're more in central Atlanta at Pond City Market. So we went from being like a short walk and like a 40-minute train ride from my house to being just a 10-minute car ride.
Yeah.
So I really lost a lot of the like core reading time that I had set aside, you know, because when you're on the train, or at least when I was on the train, like there was nothing else I could do but read the book, you know, and so there were no distractions other than, you know, some weirdo on the train doing God knows what. But aside from that, there were no distractions. I could just plug into my music, pull out a book and read. And so I've been kind of struggling to find my key reading times again.
Yeah.
In my schedule.
Yeah, I still ride the train and I take the shuttle here. So, but I haven't been reading as much, but I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks. In fact, one of the books I'm going to talk about today, I listen to entirely as an audiobook.
See, I need to get back into that
for me.
Yeah.
I actually like a lot of audiobooks. I don't think any of the ones I'm going to talk about today I experienced via audiobook, but I'm a big fan of them because I do all the cooking in our house and stuff like that, and it's good to be able to listen to a book while you cook.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. This is not related to any of the stuff I'm going to recommend today. I've told this story to Joe before, but one of the audiobooks I listened to in the last couple of years was Cormac McCarthy's The Road, and I listened to it entirely while I was exercising. And let me tell you, there is not a more depressing book to listen to while you're running.
No, but it makes you want to be in good shape so you don't become part of the supplementary band of catamites.
Yeah, exactly. I definitely was thinking about how I was getting, you know, prepared for the dystopian apocalypse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great book. I love
it. It is. Yeah.
It's pretty much everything.
I love it also.
All right. Well, let's dive into it. We're going to start with a round of our nonfiction recommendations, and then we're going to skip to our fictional recommendations. So, I'm going to kick off here by recommending a book by Douglas J. Emlyn, titled Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. This came out, I believe, earlier this year or the end of last year. So it's a new book, and it's really exceptional. It's well illustrated, and it deals, essentially it's a comparison between the evolution of organic defense systems and man-made weapons. So it looks at the arms race of evolution with a particular focus on the economics of evolution. So, you know, asking questions like, at what point is a crab claw too large? And the other side of the coin is, at what point is an arms budget too ridiculous? And there's a chapter at the end that deals with mass destruction, you know, which is more of an exclusive domain of human weaponry, something you're not going to find in the natural world. And that's where the comparison kind of breaks down and the author discusses it. But it's a fascinating read. I mean, particularly if you're interested in biology, if you're interested in warfare and weaponry, and if you're interested in fictional monsters like I am, because,
yeah.
You know, we love to throw outrageous, animal weapons that are monster designs. And it's always a fun exercise to think, why would that creature have a claw that big?
Something's gotta pay for that.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Weapons, as he discusses at length in the book, weapons are always expensive, especially state-of-the-art weapons. Mm-hmm. Whether you're talking about a medieval knight, if you're talking about an aircraft carrier, if you're talking about an exceptionally large crab claw or a set of antlers, because those things end up requiring resources from the organism. They open the organism up for more damage, for more infections, and sometimes the species goes bankrupt because the weapons budget is too large.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating thinking about some of the feedback loops that can be created in evolutionary development, especially because if you go back far enough, you can trace it to maybe a single random event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that one organism acquired a mutation that gave it a slight edge in some strange way that wasn't usual in that ecosystem before, and then suddenly every other species that competes with it had to keep up.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, because I know you're a big Grant Morrison fan, have you read We Three before?
No, that's one I need to borrow from someone at some point.
Maybe you can borrow it from me.
But,
it's related to this topic, directly in that it is about house pet animals that are weaponized by the U.S. government.
They're intelligent, right?
Yeah, they're a little above average intelligence for, you know, it's a dog, a cat, and a rabbit, but they're also like implanted with, I guess, cybernetics, and they wear sort of like exoskeletons, and they're
so this is not the natural arms, right?
No, this is not real. This is sci-fi. Yeah, but it is, it's a very emotional, comic book.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it.
I will definitely have to check that out. This book I definitely recommend. It's a very readable. You know, it's not too thick for the average or even the advanced science reader. And just like every chapter, you can just spot read this thing if you want. You know, you can just set it back on the toilet tank and pull it out whenever you just want a little bit of mind blowing science. I mean, stuff like. He spends a lot of time with stag beetles and dung beetles, you know, because they have a lot of weaponry that they've evolved on their heads for fighting. And he mentions at one point that in some male dung beetles, you actually see the diminishment of the eyes so that they can grow these elaborate fighting mechanisms. So,
interesting.
So the weapons actually like limit the sight of the organism in a very real way. That
kind of in the same way that like wearing a great helm would limit your sight as
yeah,
well.
Yeah,
yeah. Or that wearing armor limits your mobility.
Right.
I mean, all of these things come with a cost, even if it's just a cost of resource investment.
I had a feeling that going into this episode, we were going to come up with some future episode topic ideas, and this sounds like a good one.
Yeah, I think in the past, I touched on this book a little bit in an episode about antlers and one about dung beetles, but I mean, it's a great text to have around because it covers pretty much everything. It's just a wonderful dive into the topic of animal and human weaponry. So
cool.
I recommend it.
All right. Well, for my nonfiction selection, I'm going to bring up a book that's especially relevant to this podcast because we talked about it in a couple of the episodes Robert and I did, the ones about techno-religion. And this book is The Remarkable Life of John Murray Spear, Agitator for the Spirit Land by John Benedict Bucher. And I apologize to John Benedict Bucher for saying this, but every time I say his name, I want to say John Carl Buechler, who is the director of Friday the 13th, Part 7.
Wow, that's a very specific.
You don't know that this guy didn't also direct Friday the 13th, Part 7 under a pseudonym.
Well, that could be. I mean, it's close enough. They might as well be the same guy.
He might want to separate his career.
No, this guy, as far as I know, has not directed any slasher movies.
Okay.
But a good, like, spiritualist slasher movie might be worth pursuing.
Oh, yeah, that could be really cool. But I thought this story was just fascinating because this is a biography of this guy, John Murray Spear, who we talked about in the techno-religion episodes. And John Murray Spear was an activist, a reformer, an agent of political and social change. In most cases, for the better, he advocated some really progressive topics for his time. In the early to mid-1800s, he was for women's rights. He was an abolitionist against slavery. He protested against racism. And so he was, in a lot of ways, a really great guy for his time. But it's an interesting study in how even people with really admirable intentions can get swept up in bizarre belief systems, where John Murray Spear ended up becoming a spiritualist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and so he began to think that he was a medium who could channel the spirits from beyond, and he thought he could deliver the words of Benjamin Rush giving lectures on anatomy, and these were subjects he didn't know anything about.
So was this, like many spiritualists at that time, did he try to monetize this in some way? Like, did he advertise it as if, like, you know, pay him $10 and he'll tell you the secrets of the universe?
I didn't get that feeling.
No, not really.
He seemed genuine, if you will.
Okay.
I mean, maybe, I don't know, if you want to be cynical, you could maybe, because he did draw people to him through this. Like, he definitely led some projects and had some followers based on messages he was supposedly getting from the spirit world. But I don't get the sense that it was just kind of a crass cash grab. I get the sense that he was a true believer.
Yeah. Yeah, he seemed really invested in these projects. And, I mean, it's easy to think of his key project, which I'm sure you're about to discuss, as kind of an art installation. So you can almost imagine him as a gallery owner who is just super committed to curating the main art installation in this gallery.
Okay.
And less concerned with actually selling tickets.
The spiritualists of that time that I was thinking of are more like kind of, I think Joe and I have talked about this off air before, about like water diviners or oil mm-hmm, diviners, mm-hmm. And that they would, you know, obviously like, claim that spirits were able to tell them where water or oil could be found, but...
No, John Murray Spear and his followers were more into the idea that spirits could tell you how to build a machine that would save the world and become the new robot messiah.
Oh, so he's our Buckminster Fuller.
Pretty much, yeah. This is in the realm of spiritualist, he was a big thinker. He was definitely an outside-the-box thinker.
Yeah, and so this led to the New Motor Project, which we talk about at length in our episodes on techno-religion. And if you haven't heard those, you can go back and check those out for the fuller description. But basically, he and a bunch of people got together and tried to build a machine based on instructions from spirits that he thought would bring about a new era and sort of change the human's relationship with the spirit world and bring about a positive end of days in a way.
So this book that's about him, how did you find, like, you know, the structure, the prose? Is it a dense biography, or is it, you know, a readable kind of page turner?
No, it's not like highly dramatized. So he doesn't make it into a historical novel or anything. I get the sense it's more kind of an academic historian's work, but that doesn't mean it's uninteresting just because the story of John Murray Spear is so weird and so fascinating. Just in the actual details of what happened, that I think even the non-historian reader would be interested in this.
Cool. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
What's on the artwork there?
Yeah, the cover has this, I don't know, kind of creepy-looking army of cherubim surrounding what looks like a sewing machine table.
Yeah, yeah.
Seems to highlight the themes.
Yeah, there aren't a lot of great pictures of John Murray Spear's key creation. So
I don't think there's a single photograph of it.
No, just the best illustrations. We could find were a couple of illustrations, yeah.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, it looks like a table with a bunch of stuff glued to it.
Yeah, I think we described in the podcast what is a Dalek and a coffee table mated. This would be the offspring.
Yeah, pretty much. And then you hung that with some Christmas ornaments.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually a good segue into the book that I chose to talk about today for my nonfiction selection, which is, it's an ebook by Warren Ellis called Cunning Plans. Huh. And, Warren Ellis, for those of you not familiar, is primarily known as an English comic book writer. He's written a couple novels, and he's also done some commentary and columns about society and technology and sort of where we're going and how they're merging. And this ebook, which I think it's only like 99 cents on Amazon or something like that, is a collection of talks and presentations that he's given on a variety of topics over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years. One of the major categories that he covers in these talks is sort of a collision between spiritualism or magical thinking and technology and progress. So it's an interesting, you know, set of transcripts, and it reads very well, but here's just kind of a set of topics that comes up in this book. He talks about futurism, the speed at which we're progressing scientifically. The title of the book, Cunning Plans, comes from, the tradition in England that I was unaware of called the cunning folk. Have you guys heard of this before? Mm. He describes it as they were sort of like witch doctors or shaman in England at a time. And he compares the cunning folk of that time to sort of technologists of our time.
Huh, interesting.
Mystical wearables is something he talks about. He also talks about Alexander Graham Bell's harmonic telegraph, the combination of magic and the digital world, why people murder each other, pop music as sort of like a telegraph of the future, like showing us what the future is going to become, which I think is kind of a theme that Stuff to Blow Your Mind has had over the years when you write about space music on the site. And he's also, you know, no surprise, into hallucinogens and gardening on grave sites. I never thought about this, but this is one of the other things he talked about, was that apparently the soil is rather rich where dead bodies are buried. So it's easy to grow
even
crops.
Even with like modern, in modern day and age? Because we tend to just completely, cut the body off from any kind of natural.
You know, if I remember correctly from the book, it wasn't, the grave sites that he was talking about were not like modern cemeteries.
Okay,
so yeah, it was
nice
more like
old
mass graves.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not like you get your gourds from grandpa. It's like you go find
a mass grave.
Well,
it depends what grandpa was up to, I guess.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Grandpa's crawl space mushrooms.
But this is a passage I'd like to read because I think that Ellis would probably like that term, grandpa's crawl space mushrooms.
You know, sorry, that makes me think recently Rachel and I were driving through South Carolina. And
Rachel for the audience?
My wife, Rachel,
and
I were driving through... We were driving through South Carolina and we saw a little like neighborhood community that has a name. Sometimes they have names and it's called Moss Grove.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, man, that is one letter off.
Well, there's a passage from Ellis's Book of Talks that I wanted to read here today because I think it kind of captures the big ideas that he's trying to convey in these talks. And it's very stuff to blow your mind. So this is in, I believe the second one. The Olympus Mons Mountain on Mars is so tall and yet so gently sloped that were you suited and supplied correctly, ascending it would allow you to walk most of the way into space. Mars has a big puffy atmosphere that's taller than ours, but there's barely anything to it at that level. 30 pascals of pressure, which is what we get in an industrial vacuum furnace here on Earth. You may as well be in space. Imagine that. Imagine a world where you can quite literally walk into space.
Wow, that's nice.
Yeah. It's kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's a topic where I've certainly done my share of reading about the geography of Mars.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ever been presented quite like that to me, you know?
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about Ellis is that he tends to take a lot of popular science type information and he translates it in such a way that it just really brings a lot of kind of strangeness and wonder to it.
Yeah, that sounds like one that would be cool to pick up. I haven't read any of his because he has a couple of novels out, right?
Yeah, Crooked Little Vein is one of them. I can't remember the other novel's title. He was supposed to release a book called Listener, I believe, but I don't think that one came out. Hmm. But I noticed when I bought this that there were a couple of other 99-cent books by him available, which may be other collections of, you know, sort of his internet ramblings and things like that. But I've always found that kind of thing interesting. In fact, I think I was showing you guys the other day some old issues of this collection of books called Bad Signal that he put out at the early 2000s that were basically his. He would take these really sensationalist kind of weird science stories and then extrapolate them out a little bit further. They you know, for the most part, he kind of cites sources. And it was stuff from newspapers in the late 90s. Huh. And I think it would be sort of fascinating for us to take one or two of those and dive into them, see if there's some meat on the bone.
Yeah, I loved Transmetropolitan.
Yeah.
That's the one you told me to read.
Transmetropolitan is probably the one he's best known for.
Yeah, Spider Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's basically a sci-fi version of Hunter S. Thompson kind of writing about a presidential campaign.
Yeah.
Was that accurate?
Yeah, and kind of a weird, like, alien influence, dystopian, cyberpunky, gonzo future.
Transhumanism is a big theme in his works. I think one of the other ones I might have told you, Joe, to read is called Planetary, and that is sort of his, I think he describes it as like an archaeology of weird fiction. So he goes throughout the history of sort of science fiction, weird fiction, fantasy, and explores it throughout the context of this narrative in Planetary.
You know, he was involved early on in the creation of the Dead Space video game franchise.
Oh yeah,
right. And I think I don't think he's really gone on the record much with talking about like what specifically his contributions are, because I imagine there were a lot of cooks preparing that soup, but I really enjoy that gaming franchise.
So yeah, me too.
I kind of like to look at it sometime and try and figure out what in this is definitely has Ellis's DNA.
Yeah, I could see that. I had forgotten about that, but you're right. I just played Dead Space 3 last year.
Oh, yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, that one was fun.
I've never done any of those.
They're survival horror science fiction games. I think you
did.
There's a wonderful techno-religion at the center of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Cool.
All right, so there are our three promising nonfiction recommendations for you. You know, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to dive into some fiction as well. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back, and now we're going to talk a little bit about fiction. And, you know, just because it's fictional doesn't mean it's not loaded with a lot of mind-expanding topics, a lot of cool ideas. And that's why I'm always drawn to the work of Ian M. Banks.
Yeah, so
it's a recurring theme on the show.
Oh, I thought I said something funny.
No. I know that you've talked about him a lot on the show before, and we were talking about this yesterday, that I've actually never read his work before, and so I've heard nothing but good things about him, but what I've heard is that he goes by the name Ian M. Banks when he's writing science fiction, and he's just Ian Banks, right, when he's writing sort of just literary fiction?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, his sci-fi, I pretty much only read his sci-fi except for his first novel, The Wasp Factory.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's more on the sort of literary horror, I would say.
Okay.
But for the most part, I stick to his sci-fi, especially his culture series. I tend to almost always read his books exclusively at the beach. So he's kind of my go-to beach read.
So let's back up here a second. I have never thought of you as a beach person.
Yeah, well,
I'm also surprised, I'll say.
I love a good walk on the beach. I have to kind of be coaxed into doing all the other stuff, like actually getting in the water and all.
Right.
And having a toddler certainly helps with that. But,
oh, okay. Yeah.
But I love walking on the beach. I love, staring out and letting my creative juices run. I love reading at the beach. It's a good excuse to just dive into a book.
Well, I got to say that there are different kinds of beaches also, because mm-hmm. I don't consider myself a beach person in terms of like happy sunny beaches with people swimming.
But you went to the beach just a couple of weeks ago too, didn't you?
Well, that was a family thing.
Okay.
You show up for family.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I didn't hate it, but but the kind of beach I can really get behind is like the Icelandic beach, or like where it's like a gray hellscape that's beautiful.
Well, you potentially hallucinate things on the horizon.
Yeah, you're likely to see a troll walking up out of the water.
Well, I tend to not go quite that dark with my beaches, but I like a less populated beach. Mm-hmm. I don't like a bunch of people sitting around swigging beer and playing Jimmy Buffett.
Right.
I like a fairly deserted beach. I like clouds in the sky, but I also like getting my feet in the water a little bit and I prefer sand rather than painful rocks beneath me.
A doom metal kind of beach.
I guess, yeah.
No.
I don't know. That makes it sound like the sky is full of smog and there's like Viking ships on the horizon.
There you go.
All right, so you're reading Ian M. Banks at the beach, or you recommend reading it there?
I mean, it works for me, but he's great to read anywhere. So, if you want this type of science fiction journey. This particular book I read is the book Accession, which came out in 1996, and it's the fifth book in his culture series, which, if you're not familiar with it, it's essentially a post-singularity space opera that often deals with the meaning of life in a post-scarcity society, the limits of utopia, machine intelligence, alien civilizations, war, horror, wonder, and he also throws in a fair bit of silliness and humor that kind of balances everything out, a kind of, wry, almost kind of, there's almost a, like a Monty Python-esque silliness at times and the kind of pompous air to some of the characters in this universe. Which helps to balance out some of the heavier ideas that he plays with.
And he's British, right? Or he was British?
Yes.
He passed away last year.
Yeah, he died in 2013.
Oh, 2 years ago now. Okay.
But he contributed a number of books to us before passing. And the culture books aren't the only science fiction books, but they're that's the universe he keeps coming back to, or he kept coming back to a number of times.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like something I need to dive into at some point. My wife has recommended it as well.
Yeah, the weird thing about the culture series is that, first of all, it's like each book can be read on its own. It's there's stuff that happens in the universe, some key events, and there's definitely a timeline, but that timeline doesn't reflect the order in which the books are published, and so technically you can come in at any point.
Yeah.
But then some books are better entry points than others. So I always recommend The Player of Games is a great first culture book to read, as well as Consider Phlebas, which is the first one that he wrote.
Okay.
I found Player of Games was the one that I came to first, and I found that one to be the most accessible and is one of my favorite books. Accession, however, is very good too, and this one deals like all of his books, there are a number of different elements going on. There's what he calls an outside context event, which is the appearance of this thing they refer to as an accession. So an outside context event for the rest of us would be like if you were a member of a primitive tribe and you live on in some coastal environment. You know, you're catching your fish, you're cooking them over fire, and you have all these questions about how the world works beyond, you know, beyond your standard myths that have been passed on. And then you look out one day and there's, say, you know, a Spanish warship. out in the harbor. That is an outside context event. The arrival of an advanced piece of technology, an advanced civilization, the kind of thing you could not predict. And then once it is in play, you're kind of powerless against whatever changes it's going to bring into your world.
So he's extrapolating that and imagining it into sci-fi scenarios for our future.
Yeah. So. Like in the culture, which is the culture is one of several galactic civilizations that are in play in his world, and this is a very space opera age in which ships are running all over the place. Artificial intelligence is extremely powerful. There are a number of elder civilizations that have sort of gone offline. They've sublimed, as Banks refers to it.
Okay.
But this succession seems to be an entity or even some sort of a ship that originates outside of our universe.
Okay.
So it's a significant advanced step in technology, far beyond anything that any of these other civilizations have the power to grasp. And so it ends up playing into a couple of other scenarios. There's a warlike species called the Affront that want to take advantage of it. And then you have the artificial intelligence minds that run the culture, and they're trying to figure out how best to respond to it, while another faction of them are trying to figure out how to exploit the scenario to deal with the Affront. And then at the center of this, too, you have a tragic post-human love story involving two human characters. Because his post-human characters are always so interesting, because he deals with very human qualities, but the human qualities of the sort of human who can live for centuries, that can change gender as much as they want, that can, you know, essentially start and restart their lives several times and do anything they want to within this sort of semi-utopian society.
So this is sort of transhumanist as well, then?
Yes, I'm assuming.
There's like an idea, and the restarting of the lives is something that, like, the mind is separate from the body in a way?
At times, like, he explores so many different possibilities in these books. Like, there are definitely individuals who are disembodied. There are individuals who are stored away. There are individuals whose mind is put back into a new body. And then individuals in the culture tend to have like a neural lace implanted in their brain that gives them all these cybernetic interface features. They have the ability to gland different properties. So if they want to sleep without being disturbed by dreams, they just have to think about it and it happens.
Oh.
If they essentially want a powerful stimulant to rev them up, they just think about it and it happens. So they have their own sort of pharmaceutical reserves just waiting inside their head, and all they have to do is think it.
That does sound utopian.
Yeah.
I would love for a good night's sleep if I just could think about it ahead of time.
One thing I think is really interesting there is the idea of how to make a story that's sort of post-singularity or post-utopian interesting and full of conflict. That's something I think we've often seen problems with in certain incarnations of Star Trek, for example, where people wanted to go too utopian with it and say, oh, all these petty concerns people used to have, we've grown beyond that now, but then you've got no interesting conflict between the characters.
There was just that IO9.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say, so Robert, I read it and then I saw that you posted it to the Stuff to Blow Your Mind Facebook account. Mm-hmm. There was a story. You go ahead and describe it.
It was basically stemming from like a new documentary, I think, that Shatner's come out with.
Yeah.
But apparently the really interesting stuff deals with Roddenberry's involvement, Gene Roddenberry, the creator of the original Star Trek, his involvement with The Next Generation. Which it sounds like he was kind of dragged into it, but partially by his own ego, where he didn't really want to work on another Star Trek series, but he also didn't want to see it happen without him. And so you have Roddenberry and his key associates pushing for a really utopian vision of Star Trek. Everything has to be perfect within the Federation, at any rate. And then you have, you know, the other voices that are saying, but we want... We need conflict. We need these other things that are not necessarily in line with this utopian dream.
It's still supposed to be a story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the piece is written by Charlie Jane Anders, who's a regular over there and one of my favorite writers at IO9. And I suppose that you could go watch this documentary. In fact, I want to say that there might have been an embed at the link, too. But you could find it on our Facebook page, or you probably search IO9 Star Trek The Next Generation. It'll come up, too.
Yeah, I'll put a link to it on the landing page for this episode if anyone's interested.
Cool.
So, again, that book is Accession by Ian M. Banks. I recommend it. I recommend the entire Culture series.
All right, well, for my fiction selections, I didn't have anything just quite as perfect as that as a fit for this show. So I picked just a few of the books I've read recently that really wowed me. And I guess I'm going to focus specifically on one, but I'll mention a couple others first that I've read in the past year or two that amazed me. One was, I actually went back and I never read a Toni Morrison book, but I read The Bluest Eye, and that was, man, sad, painful, beautiful, brilliant. It was actually her first novel, and I get the impression a lot more people have read Beloved or later books of hers.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the main themes in this book is not necessarily the external racism that happens in society, but the internalizing of racialized concepts, like how the young black girl in the book comes to adopt basically a white supremacist conception of aesthetics that equates beauty with whiteness. Like, her idea of what beauty is what white girls' beauty is.
Okay.
And I think this is an interesting example. I mean, it's very sad in the book, but it explores the concept that our aesthetics can be charged with ideology. And I think that's something that's interesting, too, maybe worth exploring on the show sometime if we haven't before, the idea of what you find visually interesting or what you find beautiful that seems to be politically neutral, but in a lot of cases it might not be. Like, what our values are can determine what looks good to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm of the opinion that all of culture is us just trying to make sense of the sort of bombardment of chaotic information that the world presents us with, right? And no matter how you do that, it's ideological. Last night I went to a presentation of, there's a theater here in town called the Fox Theater, and they were playing Ghostbusters. They were playing the original Ghostbusters. And before it, I don't know if you guys have been to the Fox or not. This is my first time. They play old black and white newsreels from the 1930s.
Oh, wow.
And I was noticing there were a couple of them that were sort of celebrating female like stars of the time, either from, you know, the stage or maybe the radio or something like that. But I was just noticing that the conception of beauty, even in the 1930s, between now and then, is so different. So I think that there's certainly something to be said for the culture change between the then.
You know, I haven't read the Blue Eyes book, but thinking back on the episodes that Julie and I put out earlier in the year about implicit bias and racism, that work definitely came up in some of the sources that we were looking at.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was an amazing book. Another amazing one I want to mention is actually in the title, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon.
Yeah, this is a great book.
Yeah, so I've got a friend who loves Chabon, and he's been recommending this book to me for years, but I finally read it this year.
See, it's been recommended to me for years, and I've like almost read it several times.
And I think you would enjoy it.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's absolutely fantastic. It's an amazing epic story. It's epic in the way that, you know, the great Dickens novels are epic, and that, like, you're almost amazed at the end that the story has gone this far and completed this arc. And in many ways, I think this story is interesting because it's about the genesis of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it deals with how the contents of the stories that storytellers create can be equal parts inspiration, personal obsession, and just mercenary necessity, and how all those things come together to make the canons of literature we love.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've read it, maybe 10 years. But, you know, it's no secret, especially if you've just been listening to this episode, I've already mentioned two comic book writers, but I'm big on comic books. And part of the plot of Chabon's book is that these two guys create a comic book character called The Escapist.
Yes.
I believe is what the name of the book is. And this novel itself is a reflection of the Siegel and Shuster creation of Superman and the sort of political issues that went on behind that and the sleazy business that went on behind that.
Yeah.
And it's also a lot about being a Jewish American in that time and immigration, and sort of understanding, again, culturally, understanding your place in American society. And Superman, you know, it doesn't actually really show up in this book, but the Golem does.
The Golem of Prague.
And you can sort of see Superman and the Golem of Prague as like a sort of metaphors for one another.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And so I can't recommend those two books enough. And then I've got one third fiction selection that I want to mention, which is The Encyclopedia of the Dead by Daniel O'Keefe. Mm. You all ever read this?
No.
Ooh, wait, I have. Yes, this has been recommended to me, but I have not read it.
Oh, I think you'd love it, Robert. So it's called The Encyclopedia of the Dead by Danilo Kish, and Kish was a Serbian writer. He's probably more well-known among English-speaking audiences for his book A Tomb for Boris Davidovich. But this book, The Encyclopedia of the Dead, was published, I think, in 1983. The translation copyright is 1989, and the English translation was by Michael Henry Heim. And this book is fantastic, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's a book of strange, fantastical short stories. They're pretty much all about death in one way or another. And their fantastical elements are very much in the style of Borges. And some of them are just so great. I want to talk about at least one of the stories.
You have me at Borges.
Yeah. So the title story is The Encyclopedia of the Dead, and it tells the story of a woman who finds herself in a Swedish library overnight, where she locates a copy of this book called The Encyclopedia of the Dead. And it's a tome written by this religious order that makes it their duty to record every single detail about a person's life. And I mean every single detail. Every person they meet, every meal they ate, all the flowers they grew in their gardens, and then also the historical context for every period of their lives. So if you lived in World War II, the encyclopedia would also give you a complete and thorough understanding of what happened in World War II.
Okay. And these are all like on paper?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a kind of surreal
it's
element
not a digitized
there.
Digitized account.
There's a sort of like impossible absurdity
right.
to the world it describes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the narrator of this story, she finds the entry for her father, who had died just a couple months before the story takes place. And the only rule for inclusion in the Encyclopedia of the Dead is that those included in it cannot be included in any other encyclopedia.
Interesting. Hmm.
And much of the story is just the narrator trying to make notes on her father's entry before she runs out of time and has to put the book down and leave the library. But I thought this was a fascinating take, and I don't want to spoil too much about the story. You should just read it. But I think it's a fascinating take on the sort of absurdity of trying to capture human experience in language, that there's no way to really tell a story completely.
Mm.
And then there's another story in this book that I wanted to call out. It's called Simon Magus, which is just an awesome retelling of some of the apocryphal Simon Magus legends from the...
I'm unfamiliar with this.
It's early Christian tradition. Simon Magus is a character that appears in the Bible. He's in the book of Acts, and he's sort of a counter-apostle in a way. Like, he's doing some magic tricks, and he has a confrontation with Peter.
Oh, yes, Magus, M-A-G-U-S.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have heard of this guy before. Okay.
Yeah. So he has a confrontation with Peter. That's in the book of Acts, but there are also apocryphal legends that didn't make it into the Bible, but they deal in a more extensive way with Simon Magus, and he sort of has like wizard battles with Peter that are pretty cool.
Okay.
And one of those legends, actually a couple of those legends, are retold in this story. I loved this book. I thought it was awesome.
That sounds like a lot. Yeah. It touches on the things I'm interested in.
I think you guys would be into it. I'll let you borrow my copy.
Early Christian sorcery. I'm all for it.
So the wizard battle is with Peter the Apostle?
In the apocryphal sources, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Far out. It's like a Harry Potterization of the Bible.
They have like miracle contests, and they sort of like curse each other.
Oh, okay.
Nice, nice. So it kind of flows into some of what we were talking about in the Grimoire episode we did.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's where I had read about Simon. I pronounce it Magus. Maybe it's wrong, but yeah.
Oh, no, that's probably right.
About it before was that he was an inspiration for a lot of those grimoires.
I think I'm saying it the anglicized way. Magus.
Magus. But yeah, He, if I remember correctly from the research for that episode, there was even some legends that he was the one who had written some of the original text for those grimoires.
Yeah, yeah. His, and of course you end up sort of losing the individual and all the myth. Lose him completely, probably. But yeah, his name definitely came up a few times in that episode, as I recall.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, it's my turn for my fiction selection. I had two, so I feel better now that you had a couple, because I was a little worried that I had two. The first is the audiobook that I mentioned earlier that I had listened to. It is a recent novel by, I believe you pronounce her last name, Bukes, Lauren Bukes. She's a South African novelist.
Oh, yes, yes. We talked about her. She wrote
The Shining Girls. A novel that she came out with.
And then something with like animals on where everyone has animals familiar. Zoo City, that's the one I've read.
Yeah, I haven't read either. Oh, I have read part of Shining Girls, but not Zoo City. This one is called Broken Monsters. And I listened to the audiobook version of it, and I will recommend to our listeners to just read the book. The audiobook had several different actors narrating and playing the parts of the characters that are there's probably like four or five different protagonists throughout the book, and it was very distracting. There were points where I just stopped listening to it for, you know, a month at a time, and then I would come back and give it a shot again. The story is great, though. What she's written is fantastic. It's a contemporary murder mystery, sort of, you know, along the lines of that serial killer story thing that's kind of popular right now in fiction. The Detroit police find a dead body. That's how it begins. And it's the dead body of half of a young boy fused together to half of a deer. And this book just spins out from there. It's about everything from modern adolescence as it follows the daughter of the police detective investigating this murder, social media anxiety and bullying. I really felt like Bukes had her finger on the pulse of kind of what's going on in social media right now, especially for adolescents. And I suspect she's probably, you know, in her 30s at least. But she's really insightful about how that is affecting growing up. Also, something that we're familiar with, the idea of clickbait YouTube journalism. There's a character in there that's sort of trying to create his own YouTube channel personality presence. And of course, because it's in Detroit, they talk about urban renewal art quite a bit. And they go to art parties. The serial killer is an artist. There's some interesting stuff going on aesthetically with that. I found this to be a genuinely creepy and disturbing book. I read a lot of horror. I watch a lot of horror, and it takes a lot to kind of jar me. And the stuff in here jarred me. I read it. Don't listen to it.
Okay. Yeah, it's always weird with the audiobooks because they're kind of like the two approaches. One is to just have a solid narrator just reading you the books. And then it's the other direction is performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you get that weird area where you have a good narrator, but maybe he's just trying a little too hard to do like the female voices in the book or, you know, it's a weird balance. It has to,
and I'm sure, you know, our listeners can relate to this because they're listening to a podcast right now in which they're listening to our voices. And there's probably things about our voices that maybe, for instance, I know that I am accused of having vocal fry often and that can annoy listeners sometimes. But, the cadence of some of the people reading this story just rubbed me the wrong way. There was the woman who performed the adolescent girls chapters. She was a great narrator, but she was doing it from the voice of a 13, 14 year old girl. And it just grated on me after a while. I guess I'm the kind of person who prefers the audiobook where it's just a single narrator. I often prefer if it's the author themselves reading because I feel like that brings a lot to it.
Yeah, Neil Gaiman particularly.
Oh,
a fabulous job reading his own stuff.
I could imagine that he would, one audiobook that I've listened to that did a very good job with the format of having multiple actors was the audiobook for World War Z. That was the one where I was really surprised. I felt like it was actually better than the prose.
Huh.
They had, you know, several actors, including like people like Henry Rollins, come in and do the voices of some of the characters that are interviewed throughout the course of that book. So the other fiction recommendation that I have is, again, no surprise, it's a graphic novel. It is a book called High Crimes by Christopher Sabella and Ibrahim Mustafa. And it's a nice hardcover graphic novel collection of a 12-issue digital comic that these guys did over the last couple of years. And I've loved the digital version of it. I've been following it since they first came out with it. If you've seen me on video before, you might have seen me wearing a High Crimes t-shirt, actually. It's a skull with two climbing implements over it, and it's sort of in the shape of mountains, because this is a murder mystery that's set on Mount Everest. And the idea is that the main character is a climbing guide who helps people get up Mount Everest, but also on the side, she robs the bodies of people who have died on Mount Everest, and then promises to return either the bodies or their property to their families who are living back home for a fee, you know, for a price. So she's kind of like a vulture scavenger on Mount Everest. And the plot is that she finds a body that has a connection to a government conspiracy back in the United States. So this leads to, you know, she tries to sell this stuff. It leads to a sort of cat and mouse game chasing up Mount Everest. But it's meticulously researched. Sabella does a really good job of depicting what climbing Everest is like. Not that I've done it, but it seemed very well researched, down to the equipment, the effects on the human body, especially at the like different sort of zones of the mountain itself. Yeah, I did climb Mount Kinabalu when I was younger, which is in Malaysia, in Borneo, and it reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah, I know that it's come up in episodes before here at Stuff to Blow Your Mind, discussing just what the environment is like as you ascend a particularly high mountain, and the atmospheric changes and the effects it has on the brain. It's sort of really fascinating stuff.
And the character is a drug addict too, so it's interesting to see like her going through. She's jonesing really as she's traveling up the mountain, because she sort of runs out of stuff. That effect combined with the effects of the environment.
Oh, that makes me wonder if anybody climbs mountains to get like hypoxia trips.
Sounds like an episode. It will now.
All right, so now we're going to finish up the podcast here by just going around and discussing what we're reading now and what we're hoping to read in the future. What's on the plate? And this, you know, will be another good place for the listeners to say, yes, those are great selections, or no, don't read that. That's horrible. Or mention some things that are in the same vein. So I'll start. Right now, I am just jumping back into a reread of Frank Herbert's 1965 sci-fi classic Dune, because this is the 50th anniversary of the book. And Joe and I are actually planning to do a couple of episodes on the science of Dune.
Yeah, is also on my now reading list.
Yes, you're currently reading it as well. So I've also picked up The Science of Dune, edited by Kevin R. Grazier, Ph.D., which is a collection of essays in which different individuals analyze the science of everything from the still suit to the sandworm to the consumption of spice and its effects on the human mind. And then I also picked up a copy of the Dune Encyclopedia from the 1980s, compiled by Dr. Willis E. McNally. And this has been long out of print, so the book just smells fabulous. It has that wonderful 1980s aroma to it. And this is a book I have a lot of nostalgia for, because before I read any of the Dune books, I picked this up at my local small town library and just started going through it, and just, you know, they have all these different encyclopedic entries about various factions, family members, individuals, technologies that make up the Dune universe, and it's just really inspiring stuff. It's not all canon, because it came out before Herbert had written all of his Dune books, but it's wonderful stuff.
I'm surprised there isn't a revised version that is still in circulation, given the popularity of that series.
You'd think they would, especially. I mean, it's still an industry of the Dune books are still an industry.
So. You know, I wonder if the internet, like having the web, has really cut into stuff like fictional canon encyclopedias. Because when I was a kid, I remember a lot of these things. When I was looking at this Dune encyclopedia book, I was like, oh man, I got that feeling like this is a book I would have found somewhere when I was a kid, like in a, you know, beach house or something like that. And then sat down and started flipping through it and suddenly the entire day's gone. It has that feeling because I don't know, for some reason when I was a kid that I loved stuff like that. Star Wars encyclopedias.
Oh, yeah. I had the Star Trek, it's like, I forget what it was called, but it was like a guide to the alien species of Star Trek.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And it was, this came out like, you know, Next Generation era. So, each spread had, you know, a nice little black and white drawing of the species and then, you know, some very encyclopedic information about them in their home world. And, yeah, I just remember pouring myself into that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you're right that Wikipedia and like other sort of Wikia data entry sites have sort of taken over that place, but there's still something nice about holding a book like that. Like, I love reading RPG manual.
Oh yeah,
even for games that I'll never play.
Yeah, I'm a sucker for a monster manual.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Give me a good monster manual, and I'll lose myself in it.
You know, Robert's the guy to consult. I remember a while back, I was wondering what kind of save do you have to throw from somebody trying to drive you mad if they're casting a drive you mad spell. What did you say, Robert?
I can't remember what my specific answer was, but I looked in the latest Dungeon Master Guide, and also my Call of Cthulhu book. So,
oh, I love Call of Cthulhu. Was it the D100 version?
I don't know. I don't think it's the most current edition.
Yeah, that's the D100 is the older one.
Okay.
I think that somebody else, another company, maybe bought it out. But Chaosium is the company.
Yeah, and this one definitely came from that company. Yeah.
That could be a great, like, workplace RPG. Like, you know, you get pulled into the meeting room and the boss monster is about to drive you mad and you have to throw.
I feel anytime I'm in a long meeting, I start losing
sanity.
Points.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially when you're in a conference call.
Oh, yeah. Minus 5 sanity points right off the bat. and then briefly, what's on the plate for later? I fall into the trap every year of just thinking more about things I want to reread that I love rather than exploring new things. So, along those lines, I would love to have some recommendations from other people, but I feel like I need to reread R. Scott Baker's The Judging Eye and The White Luck Lawyer would be a different novel entirely.
That's the new, what's his name, John Graham or John Grisham?
John Grisham book. Yeah.
The White Luck Lawyer.
Yeah, actually, The White Luck Warrior, which is the second book in his second trilogy that all takes place in his dark fantasy, highly, you know, philosophical world of the second apocalypse. But he has the third book in this series coming out at some point in the next several months, hopefully, titled The Unholy Consult. So I want to make sure that I dive back into that world fully. And then there are a number. I feel like I probably need to finish reading Stephen King's Revival because people keep telling me it's good.
I still haven't finished that one.
Yeah.
Or started it, rather. Yeah, it's been on my list.
Yeah, I hear it has some wonderful science fiction elements in it, but I just need to press further along in it, I guess. And then we're going to hit Halloween, so I'll probably reread some Ligotti, some King, some Lovecraft, some Clark Ashton Smith, and, of course, Brian McNaughton, my all-time favorite horror writer. So that's what's on the plate for me.
Well, as I said, I'm also reading Dune right now, and I'm loving it so far. I love the richness of the world, how complete it feels. We were just talking the other day about how going back and reading Dune, I feel some elements that you see in the George R. R. Martin Game of Thrones universe feel sort of not lifted from Dune, but similar to Dune in terms of, you know, all the backstabbing and these warring houses. And
I wouldn't be surprised if it was a big influence on him, at least in terms of structure and, I guess, epicness.
Yeah, I feel it's definitely a work that its roots spread throughout genre fiction for decades to come, for decades to follow.
So I'm absolutely loving it, and I can't wait to do the Science of Dune episode. But also, I was reading a book when I started reading Dune that I need to pick back up because I loved this one as well. It was The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
Have you
all read this?
Yeah, I read that a while ago. What was it? The story with that was it came out in like the 90s and then she didn't write another book for like 12 years or something, right? And I think Little Friend is the other book that she's come out with since then.
Actually, I didn't even look this up. I have no idea when this book was written.
Okay.
But I thought it was fantastic so far.
Yeah, it's good.
The prose is one of those books that, you know, this sounds like such a reviewer's cliche, but it's very rich. meaning sort of the opposite of minimalist or stark or bare. It's just overflowing with ideas and images and jokes and verisimilitudes. And so I was really loving that one. It deals also with the kind of weird cult-like behavior that can sometimes arise in a, you know, college professor and student scenario.
Absolutely. I had a professor exactly like this, the one that was in The Secret History.
Yeah.
And I had a sort of classroom unit that was very worshipped him in a similar way. And if I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I read it, but isn't he a Greek historian?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about historian. Maybe. I haven't finished the book yet, but okay. Yeah, he teaches Greek and classics and he talks about Greek philosophy a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
He does these sort of like long monologues, these lectures that the students just find all this crazy inspiration in. So far, the book was awesome, and yeah. I'll have to go back to it once I'm finished with Dune. But then also lined up next, I've been thinking about how I've apparently got to read some Ian M. Banks. So there we go on that. But that also I was thinking about reading Susan Blackmore's The Meme Machine, which is a nonfiction book that she wrote about mimetic theory. And Christian, you're kind of smirking.
I have an interesting story about this book. So I read this book early 2000s, and I loved it. It's really good. I think that, and if you're looking for sort of an explanation of Dawkins' mimetics theory, this is a good place to start. I made the mistake of, in my early 20s, taking a young lady, a delightful young lady, to a Susan Blackmore presentation as our first date. So, you know, Not pretentious at all to go, do you want to go hear about mimetics from this British author with pink hair?
I love her hair.
Oh, yeah. She's
a badass.
She's come up in past episodes before.
Right? Oh, yeah.
We've used her work.
No, she was super cool.
I've seen YouTube videos of her giving, like, speeches and stuff. She seems really awesome in person. I've never read a book of hers. So I wanted to read this also because I've read a little bit about meme theory. Like, you know, I read Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, which came out in the 70s, and I think that was the first major exploration of meme theory.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And if you're not familiar with meme theory, it's the idea that there are units of cultural copying and transmission analogous to genes in living organisms, but in culture, they're called memes, and they're just like genes. They get copied with mutations throughout generations.
Yeah, I would also add to this, at least from my experience in graduate school, that the theories of mimetics of Dawkins and Blackmore are heavily frowned upon.
A lot of people hate them.
Yeah, they don't feel like it has any quantitative value.
Yep. I've heard that too.
I still think that they're interesting. And in fact, we did a What's a Meme episode for Brain Stuff that our colleague Jonathan Strickland performed. So if you want just like a short 5-minute primer on mimetics, go find that.
Yeah, of course. Then again, one thing I will say is that it seems like a lot of the criticisms of mimetics that I've heard, now I'm sure there are some very good criticisms. Some of the ones I've heard kind of rang hollow to me, and also seemed like they were coming from people who personally disliked the people who promote meme theory.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the deal with that is, but I'll see once I read the book.
Well, I am currently reading a book called Devils and Demons that I picked up at our local used bookstore, The Book Nook. It is a collection of short stories all about hell, demons, and Satan that are selected by a guy named Marvin Kaye, and this book was published in 1987. Some of it isn't really my thing. Some of it's not for me. But there have so far been some good stories I've read in here. Paula Volsky wrote a story called The Tendency of Mr. Eakes. There's a great Robert Bloch story in here called Enoch, if you haven't read that
before.
I've
read that one, but he's a legend.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And then this book led me down the rabbit hole to really get into Arthur Machen. Because I've only read a little bit of his stuff before, but there's a story in here called The Novel of the White Powder by him, which led me to, again, going on to Amazon. It turns out that Amazon has these collections of books like Machen's work. You can buy like 25 of his stories for 99 cents. So I got this collection, and over this last week, I actually just read The Great God Pan. Have you guys read this before?
That is an incredibly potent and creepy tale.
Yeah, it's a novella that he wrote, first was published in 1890, and it is, you know, it's probably like one of the unsung stories of the history of horror literature. I'd never heard of it until just the last, you know, maybe two or three weeks, but it's hugely influential. Lovecraft called it, he said, no one could begin to describe the cumulative suspense and ultimate horror with which every paragraph abounds in that story. And Stephen King said he thinks it's one of the best horror stories ever written, maybe the best in the English language.
Hmm.
I really enjoyed it.
Wow, I'll have to check that out.
I'm planning to really take a deep dive into Arthur Machen's material. And then what I've got on the plate for later, probably after I read all that Machen stuff, although I might dabble in this stuff back and forth, a friend of mine recommended this book by a guy named Laird Barron, who is another sort of weird fiction horror author. And this is a collection of his short stories called Occultation.
Hmm.
And all I know about this guy is he's won a bunch of awards. He's a former Iditarod racer. And my friend, who is a horror writer, just sings his praises, loves his stuff.
Yeah, this is an author that keeps coming up in at least automated recommendations for me.
It's
like Amazon. And his, of course, his name stands out so much. I probably need to check out some of his work as well. Like I say, I keep falling into the habit of rereading things, while I should really branch out and explore some more contemporary horror authors.
Well, I can let you borrow this when I am done with it. I'm really looking forward to the idea of bouncing back and forth between a guy who's contemporary like this and a guy who was alive over 100 years ago, really kind of writing similar stuff, with Arthur Machen, Arthur Machen's, kind of huge, collection of short stories.
Yeah, I feel like you guys are really showing me up in terms of appropriately weird stuff here. I'm going to have to catch up for next year.
Oh, no.
It's going to be all sci-fi and demons for 365 days.
That's going to heavily influence the show. I think I'm already weighing us in the demon category, maybe a little bit too much. But that John Murray Spear book sounds really interesting, and I've never heard of, is it Danilo Kiss? Is that how
Kish,
you pronounce it?
I think.
Kish.
Okay. Well, there's a K-I-S, and there's the little carrot over the S, so I think the Serbo-Croatian way of saying that would be quiche, but
yeah.
I apologize if that is wrong.
I believe that sounds appropriately weird, the Encyclopedia of the Dead.
Yeah.
Now, Arthur Machen and the Great God Pan and all that, I think I originally saw reference to it in one of Lovecraft's essays about supernatural and
quote that I just read from was from Lovecraft's book, is it Supernatural Literature and Horror, or Supernatural Horror in Literature. It's a short nonfiction book that I believe he put, this is all off the top of my head, but I believe that Lovecraft compiled it from letters that he shared with people like Robert Bloch, who were sort of in his circle of horror writer fans, and he sort of came up with this guide of how to write horror literature. Yeah, and that's where it was mentioned. Where I pulled that quote from, at least. So maybe that's where you saw it.
Yeah, I also was turned on to a number of like old classic and horror and pulp writers. I used to go to a wrestling message board, and one of the contributors there was this guy. It was this guy John Pellin, who is a horror writer and editor. Do a search for his name, you'll see various anthologies he's edited. I think he's worked with Edward Lee on a few different books, and he has an encyclopedic knowledge of horror literature. So he turned me on to a number of key authors that I've grown to just completely adore, like Michael Shea.
Yeah, Michael Shea actually wrote the introduction to that Laird Barron book I'm about to read. Yeah, and I also thought of you as I was flipping through this last night and reading all the sort of in praise of Laird Barron stuff at the beginning, because he got a write-up from S.T. Joshi in here.
Who's been on the show.
You had S.T. Joshi on the show, yeah. Yeah,
who's
sort of, for those of who don't know, S.T. Joshi is, I guess, like the
Lovecraft scholar?
Yeah, he's known as the scholar of sort of weird fiction.
Yeah, and if Michael Shea recommends this guy, all the more reason. Shea was just brilliant, and he sadly passed in the last year or so. But he wrote science fiction, fantasy, and horror. But his dark fantasy work, particularly his Niflheim tales, are just beautiful, just phenomenal. Most of them deal with journeys into the subworlds, which are kind of a fantasy a fantastic Dante-esque underworld, except with just concentric layers of awfulness and wonder. And he that man had a gift.
So that's yet another person I'm adding just to the piece of paper. Just between the three of us talking, I have a list here of probably 10 different things I need to read. But I'm still curious of what the audience is going to recommend
Indeed.
To us after hearing of what we would recommend to them, what we're reading right now, and what we're going to read next.
That's right. So, hey, in the meantime, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, all the videos, all the blog posts, and the landing page for this episode, again, will feature all the titles and authors that we've mentioned here with appropriate links out to places you can buy them.
And if you want to let us know what books you recommend we read, and maybe if we really like them, we'll repeat them back out to our audience and spread your ideas throughout the population, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.